Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Underrated Movie Podcast. This is a podcast where we discuss shows that are underrated, underappreciated, and ones that have flown under the radar and passed most people by. I am your host, Derek McDuff, and today I am joined by a special guest, Pat Mayo, the host of the Pat Mayo Show, the Pat Mayo Experience, and he runs the Pat Mayo Media Network. Pat, how is it going? Thanks for being on, man.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so glad to be here that I can talk about this movie with anyone, because there are so few people in the world that you can actually talk about this movie with. However, it might not fall into the underrated category. Underappreciated, maybe, but it's probably quite properly rated.
Well, yeah, that's why I like to cast a wide net. You know, any movie out there that maybe deserves a little more love, deserves to shine a light on, you know, for whatever reason, we like to talk about here at Underrated. And so, yeah, the movie that we're alluding to, of course, if you've seen the title, is Southland Tales, a 2007 film written and directed by Richard Kelly with a vast ensemble cast that were apparently cast against type on purpose, because Richard Kelly thought that they all had secret hidden talents, which is interesting. But yeah, this is very much a cult classic film that arrived at the Cannes Film Festival in 2006 and had a very mixed reaction from critics, a very mixed reaction from audiences, did very poorly at the box office, but has become, you know, kind of a cult hit. This is maybe one of the most divisive films I've ever seen. There's a lot of chat about this one, much like Donnie Darko, his previous effort, on the internet about people who hate it, but people who love it. So yeah, as soon as you suggested it to me, I was intrigued in doing this one. But Pat, before we get into all that, I mean, I'm sure you're a man who needs no introduction, but why don't you tell the people about yourself and your shows?
Yeah, I'm guessing that most people in the film review world probably do not know who I am. I have a show, a daily talk show, mostly sports, mainly sports betting about football and golf, but we do entertainment, we do politics, we do pop culture, we do all that fun stuff too, sandwiched in between, but it's a daily show, the Pat Mayo Experience for the audio versions, Mayo Media Network on YouTube, and myriad other places as well, but those are the main places you can find my show, and, you know, check me out on X at the PME, very easy to get in touch with me, but it's funny because you said it had mixed reactions. There was not really a lot of mixed reactions on this movie. There was just poor reactions to this movie.
Yeah, that's fair. But, you know, what I think over the years is kind of earned its just, yeah, like I read, you know, just doing a little research for this, read the initial feedback that the critics had in that initial festival run, and people were angry at this. There was a few critics that gave it positive reviews. You know, I think it has, you know, like a 40%, 41% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is not good, but I think it kind of shows that this movie was kind of split mostly down the middle of people liked it or didn't. But, you know, what was your initial reaction to this movie?
I loved it. I was really getting into David Lynch at the time, and it reminded me of you can almost call it a bizarro version of a bunch of different filmmakers, like in another world. This is a bad Philip K. Dick novel. It's a bad David Lynch movie. But this movie, even though it's split down the middle critically, let's say, at 41%, and it's generous to call it down the middle, I don't think that anyone actually thinks this is a good movie, but it's a movie that you need to vibe with. If you can vibe with this movie and just kind of turn your brain off and just kind of sit there, like I watched it for the first time in theaters, stoned out of my mind. And yeah, that's probably the best way to watch it when you're not really critically thinking too much about it, because there's way too much backstory. It's like, you know, 20 pounds of potatoes stuffed into an 8-pound bag.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I was watching it and I was like, there is so much here. And he literally does the same thing that Star Wars does, where he's like, here's 4 through 6. Like, it's, and you're like, oh, okay, I guess he's just like skipping over 1 through 3, the same way that the original Star Wars trilogy was, you know, 4, 5, and 6. And then, you know, we went back, and I guess there was like a graphic novel that was released that was supposed to be 1 through 3. But there's just so much in this movie. There's like at a certain point, I was like, I'm going to stop trying following the plot and future people traveling back and porn stars that are actually like secret underground people, and who's working for who, and who, like Will Sasso is actually secretly this guy, and then you know, it's a lot, and there's a lot of, you know, like I said, there's a huge ensemble cast, but then somebody like Janine Garofalo will show up and you're like, oh, she's in this. This is great. So it is a movie though that, like you said, you have to kind of just give yourself over to the vibes. Let, you know, the waves, the perpetual motion of it all just kind of flow over you and just kind of have this very bizarre experience. And I'm a person who likes to go on Letterboxd a lot. I was really curious to see, like, what is Letterboxd think of this? And you can always kind of see the bell curve on Letterboxd. Usually, if a movie is, like, rated at 3, you'll have, like, a pretty even distribution there. It'll be in the middle, mostly 3s, and then it'll go, like, you know, taper off towards the 5s and the 1 stars. But this one, it's the weirdest bell curve distribution I've ever seen on Letterboxd, where there's, like, a ton of 5s, there's a ton of half stars, and it's just, like, jagged teeth looking at the scores for this thing. And it has a perfect 3.0. And then I like looked at some of my friends' reviews and people I follow and stuff. And a couple of film critics I like a lot have given this like 4 stars. And I was just like, that's bizarre. And then some other ones I've liked a lot gave it 1 star. I was like, that checks out for this movie because, yeah, it's something where you're like, what even is this? It's a movie that I'm like, do I need to watch this again? And maybe, honestly, you had the right idea. Being in an inebriated state, I could see this as a movie where it's like, yeah, maybe, you know, you have a couple of drinks, you know, you smoke a little something and just kind of be like, whatever, just let it hit you.
I watched it the other night in preparation for this. My wife walked in about 45 minutes into it and she just had question after question about what's going on. And I had to tell her, look, I don't really know what's going on. You just kind of have to go with it. She's like, is that Sarah Michelle Gellar? It's like, yeah, it is. It's like, she a porn star? It's like, yeah, she is. She's also working in conjunction with an underground Marxist movement at the same time. Just go with it. It doesn't really make that much sense. But here we are. The weird thing about this movie is that 15 years later, and I have read those graphic novels, by the way. It was in like 2008. I found it like a, I think it was on like LimeWire. I was able to download a PDF of it.
Okay.
It does help it make a little bit more sense. Like, you can see this would have been a really good, like, 12-episode Netflix show, I think. I don't think it would be good, necessarily, but I think it would have made a lot... It would have been much more cogent, put it that way.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it does have that feel of just it very overstuffed. Like, there's just way too much. Like, you just get into it without... And it's interesting, because they're, like... There should be a fish-out-of-water character, because, like, the main character, even though it's more of an ensemble, is... does have amnesia, so it's like, okay, cool, we could just explain the world to him, but it's like, no, we skipped that scene, and it's just like, all right. But yeah, it's just so bizarre, so weird, and it's one of these movies that it's just trying something, and I respect it so deeply for that. That any, like, a movie that it's not playing it safe at all, it's not saying, here's the conventions that you know, here's the easy way to do something. Like, this Richard Kelly, he really had a vision. He's like, I'm going to make this dark, dystopian, black comedy about, like, it's just going to start with nukes going off, and it's just going to be about, like, you know, how America's just going down this road. And like, there's some things you watch, you're like, huh, that's kind of like they talk about, you know, and it's a lot of juvenile humor, like, that is kind of, like, going up against this, like, weird, heady stuff. But it'll be like, here's Prop 69. You're like, did that almost kind of predict, like, them trying to get rid of net neutrality? Like, all these, like, little things is just, like, about, like, the creeping, like, this, you know, the overreach of, like, government and stuff like that. You're like, this is very interesting. And yeah, it's not like genius or anything, but you're like, there's some interesting ideas in here, and I love that they're trying these things, you know.
It's too many interesting ideas for one movie to handle is the problem, because it has no resolution really on any of it. And it's funny, because the reason that I got into this movie in the first place was I didn't like Donnie Darko at all. I thought it was absolutely terrible. So I'm one of those, it's funny because all of his films kind of have that, although far more people enjoy Donnie Darko to really hating it. I actively hated Donnie Darko. And then this movie comes up. I see it's from Richard Kelly. It's like, well, I don't know if I really want to watch this, but I came of age, hit my adolescence at the time when the Attitude era in the WWF was just getting big. So I was a big The Rock fan. Around that same time, American Pie comes out. Who doesn't love Stifler? It's like, wow, you got The Rock and Stifler. Same reason I saw the movie The Rundown. They have these two guys in it. This sounds great. I'm going to go check this out. And I was just completely blown away by everything that happened in this movie. But you talk about the prescience of some of this stuff, and even to watch it almost 20 years later, like the Wallace Shawn character is basically Elon Musk.
Yeah. I was thinking he's just like, he's this just egomaniacal guy from, you know, like in this case, Germany instead of South Africa. But yeah, he's just like, I'm going to save the world. And it's going to be this technology that is just like so advanced. And, you know, and it's like, yeah, okay, whatever. Like, and he's just trying to basically own the world, own everything. He's got this very devoted, almost cult-like group of fans and everything. And it's like, oh yeah, he pitches himself as this savior of the world, but it's actually like the things he's doing are probably not that great for the world. And I think, yeah, he's a very, very, that's an interesting parallel that I think I was kind of thinking about. Yeah.
Even something as much as throughout the course of the movie, obviously it's taking place in what is the somewhat in the future, but the 2008 presidential election. It would be the end of the Bush era into whatever this is going to be. And there's a lot of the net neutrality stuff that would come out of the Patriot Act. And that's like a big plot point. It's not even really a plot point, just things that are happening in the movie. Calling anything a plot point is a bit generous for this movie. But he is cozying up to the Republican and right-wing side of everything, but he's secretly funding the neo-Marxists at the same time. Like, he's actively playing both sides. He has developed a technology where you don't need to use gas anymore. You can try to save the Earth through these, you know, Wi-Fi cars of this power that he has invented. So it kind of stuck out to me watching it this time around. It's like, huh, they were... Because this movie and Idiocracy came out at the same time, and everyone points to Idiocracy as like, yeah, this is basically the future, and we're there at this point. This movie is leaning somewhat on that as well. Like, hey, even how they consume media, and Sarah Michelle, like, there was no one talking about being a brand, a porn star being a brand in 2007 outside of this movie. Now, every porn star is a brand. They have energy drinks. They have Instagram followings. Like, that is a major part of this movie.
Yeah, and just, like, the kind of influencer culture in general, like, porn stars, but, like, everybody else, when Amy Poehler and her husband are, like, they're, you know, they're these, like, these Marxist anarchists, like, but they're also, you know, they're like, oh, well, we've got to go in disguise because we're known people, and, you know, they're, like, one of the people is, like, a stand-up comedian. It's like, yeah, everybody is a brand, everybody is an influencer, they're all these, quote-unquote, content creators. They're out there in the world. They're like, we're going to do all these things. We're going to stage all this stuff. And just, yeah, it really is. And then one more thing that I thought was the Elon Musk thing. It's like, yeah, his great groundbreaking vehicle, it blows up just like Elon's first three rockets or whatever, you know? Like, so I thought, yeah, it does feel, maybe he had some kind of, like, maybe, you know, Richard Kelly was able to time travel like The Rock. It wouldn't make any sense, just like this movie. And it's like, what's going on with the Jesus stuff? Like, he's, Sean William Scott is a savior. Like, what, like, it's one of those things, they just throw so much stuff at the wall that I think some of it's going to hit. And if you can kind of just give yourself over to this experience, like you said, I don't know that it's a good movie, but, like, it's one of those things just like, What is even, it's an interesting experience, and I'm really glad that I got to do it and watch it and experience this, and I'm really glad that, you know, he was given an opportunity to make this movie.
You see so many run-of-the-mill movies, obviously not with this sort of really deep bench of comedic actors in this movie. And someone once told me that if you watch this movie as a satire, it becomes a lot more palatable for people. So I've kind of adjusted my mind a little bit to thinking that. I think that's a lot of retroactive, like, retconning this movie, that Richard Kelly wrote it as a satire. I don't necessarily
know. It's like The Room. He's like, it was a comedy.
Yeah, it was a comedy the whole time. Don't worry about that. I don't know if that was necessarily the case. Maybe it was. And that's how, if you choose to view it through that lens, it becomes a whole lot better. But I just, it's like with the con thing, like you were talking about, it had unfinished VFX at con. And you can go back and watch the con cut now. I think they ended up putting like an extra $2 million into the movie to have the VFX. And some of the visual effects are really good. Some of them are truly horrendous. The one thing that undermines this movie more than anything is that there are some really cringe roles in it, in specific parts. You mentioned the 69 stuff. Maybe, like, I can't really even transport myself back into that time to be like, oh, is this, like, really hilarious? Because it's not when you watch the movie. And they say it so many times that it's like, all right, man, we get it. Like, if it was just once, that would be fine. And that whole character at the end, the guy that drives Sean William Scott to go meet himself, is unbearably bad.
Yeah, and because it honestly does feel like this was a really good script written by, like, a 14-year-old, where he's like, I've got all these ideas, man, and it's going to be like, the government's going to get you, and it's going to be funny, dude. I'm going to put some stuff about, like, 69 and baby farts in there, and it's like, yeah, it feels pretty juvenile, honestly, but you got to kind of respect that, and I always do respect a movie that is doing something different. The first movie we ever covered on Underrated was Speed Racer, which came out around the same time, 2008. And that's a movie that I think is, like, unabashedly a just masterpiece that, like, critics missed on and, like, audiences missed on. This is not in that same category, but I think that they're at least reaching for something similar, which is, like, we're trying to do something big and bold and different. And I don't know that a movie like this gets made today, because the movies where it's like, yeah, you can have an up-and-coming director and just have, if he has, like, a great cast and just let him just do whatever, those days are kind of gone. Now it's like, yeah, we'll just, like, this guy would just be tapped to, you know, make, I don't know, the, like, next Planet of the Apes movie or the next Spider-Man movie or something.
Yeah, like, if you had a big hit, yeah, Richard Kelly wouldn't be directing a $17 million Southland Tales. He'd be directing a $200 million Star Wars offshoot, like, Rogue One sequel or something like that.
Yeah, honestly, exactly.
Have you ever seen Cloud Atlas?
You know, interesting enough, that's one we just covered. I love that movie.
So, I've never seen it, but I read some of the reviews for it, and they sound suspiciously like the reviews for this movie. Now, albeit, it's probably a better movie, it looks better, better directed, better acting, but just the confusion that people seem to have for that movie seems very similar to this one.
And that's interesting, yeah, because I think there are a lot of parallels, you know, and I brought up Speed Racer, and then, you know, Cloud Atlas is obviously also done by the Wachowskis, because I think they're people that have these grand ideas. And I think that Cloud Atlas works, is like this, where it throws a lot of stuff at the fan and just, or the wall, and just sees whatever sticks, you know? And I think that Cloud Atlas works a little bit better because there is a more kind of cohesive, singular idea that holds everything together, which is about how we're all connected and just about how these divisions that humanity has are all just kind of artificially imposed upon us. And so all those different disparate ideas kind of stick together. And I know that movie is another one where people don't like people really hate it. And I talked about that on the episode, how, like, Time named it, like, their worst movie of the year, which is ridiculous. But I could see the parallels between that, where they are trying all these things. Do you think there's a singular idea in this, like there is in Cloud Atlas, that kind of hangs everything together?
No, because the part that we haven't mentioned at all either, like, Justin Timberlake's in this movie, he is the narrator, and it's based on the Book of Revelations.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So you have that part. I like what you're saying, though. Like, you don't see, like, when you say that something like Cloud Atlas and Time Magazine names it the worst movie of the year, you don't get to be named the worst movie of the year unless you're really trying something. I kind of equate it to, listen, there's three outcomes in baseball at this point. Either people walk, they hit a home run, or they strike out. This movie is just, there's no walking. Richard Kelly is swinging at every pitch that's coming in, and he's trying to hit a home run. And he misses a lot of the time. But there are a few here that clear the fence. Like, he's not trying to take a walk and draw the count and wear out the pitcher and sack bunt the guy over to second base and try to sacrifice fly him in with something. There's no small ball when it comes to this movie. It's just taking home run cuts the entire time. And if you're doing that, the people that are actively going to dislike your movie are just going to be so wide versus a very by the book crappy movie. Like, I was trying to think of, like, other movies that came around in this time that I probably saw in theaters, like the remake of Last House on the Left, which is just really bad, but, like, it's generically bad. Like, no one even thinks about that movie because it's so bad and forgettable. There's nothing forgettable about Southland Tales, which I think is a credit to it.
Yeah, honestly, and it's interesting that you use the baseball metaphor, because that's something that I use a lot with these movies too. I kind of like invented a category that I call them, where I call them big swings, for the exact same reason, where it's like, yeah, they are going to take this huge swing on this movie where they're either going to like strike out or hit a home run. And I did like a whole, back in the day, I did like a whole mini series about these movies that I thought fit into this category. And this kind of hits all those checks except for one. I think I had, like I said, they had to be like over $100 million because these big things. But like, you know, it's got like all this world building, just really like interesting like characters and like all this stuff there. It is trying all these things. And so, yeah, I think that this is kind of a, although it's a smaller budget, it's a big budget for this kind of film. So it is definitely taking that big swing. And yeah, movies like that are always going to be judged a little more harshly when they don't land. It's a lot, you know, if it's something that's like a safe bet, doesn't, like, nobody cares that Pompeii, that movie didn't, you know, light the world on fire, no pun intended. But when this is just, because it's just like, whatever, it's just like a dumb action movie, who cares? But when this is like so big on bombastic and doesn't work, people like I remember years back, there was this YouTube channel that I followed, and the guy did like a whole video essay about how he thought this was his least favorite movie of all time. And that was one of the points he was. It's like, yeah, this was very ambitious and it didn't work. And for me, I will always like a movie like that much more than the Emoji Movie, something that is just a cheap cash grab that isn't saying anything, it isn't trying anything, that's just going to try to be lowest common denominator entertaining schlock and not really do anything or kind of be about anything bigger than itself. And this movie was trying to be about something bigger, a lot of things, too many things, as you said, but it's trying.
Like, in another world, if this is done right, it could have the critical praise. I can't believe I'm saying this. But think about Mulholland Drive, how that is a critically lauded movie. I love Mulholland Drive. I probably watch it 40 times. I still don't quite know what's going on in the movie. But again, it's just a vibes movie. But David Lynch gets so much credit for actively being a visual artist and really creating vibes in a movie. And that's a movie that people can vibe with. And it's a mystery, although no one really knows even what the mystery is or how it's resolved. And in this one, there's just too much going on, where in Mulholland Drive, sometimes it feels like there's too little going on. And that's sort of where I think the clash comes in, why people don't like this movie, is that if you're going to have an ambitious movie, maybe it's not best to try to say anything in it if you're going to rely on stylization and sort of like dreamlike whimsy. Maybe it's because it takes place in the not too distant future that you can have your one thing that you want to say. And like you mentioned, that we've talked about that, not the 17 things that you want to say, really kind of hammer down on the one thing.
Yeah. And I want to touch back on a point you made earlier, which we said, like, this probably, you know, would not be a movie that gets made today, but it might be like a mini series, you know, or like a TV show that gets made today. And Richard Kelly's even talked about going back to this universe and doing a TV show, because I think that would work, honestly. I think may at least work better than the movie. I was thinking of Far Away Downs, which, if anybody who doesn't know, is Baz Luhrmann went back and recut Australia into like a 6-part miniseries. And I think that's something that really benefited from this format, and this could benefit from the format as well, where I think Australia is similarly kind of overstuffed. This is a 3-hour movie. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of plots. But when you are able to do that into a more long form, stretched out into episodes, which this is already broken up into episodes, so it would make sense. Like, if he had, so, you know, he obviously has a lot of footage, a lot of it's undone. I don't know that he would be able to get the budget to put in the FX and stuff like that, but I could see it really working as like, yeah, this is like a 6-part miniseries, it's a 7-part miniseries, whatever. Put it out on one of those prestige networks or Hulu or something like that, or FX or whatever. I could see this being a lot more palatable.
I know that The Irishman was nominated for Best Picture and people really seemed to like it, but I always thought The Irishman should have been like a 5-part miniseries rather than a movie, because I actively started to hate it halfway through because it was too long.
I agree.
Like, if you want to make a 5-hour movie or a 4-hour movie, that's fine. Just break it up into like 45-minute segments, and then I can watch at my own pace and not feel like I have to be glued to it the entire time. That's also a part of this movie that people, I think, really hated, is that it's so long.
Yeah, it's kind of, there's, you're just like, wow, this thing, I was watching it and I kept being like, okay, how much? I was like, oh my gosh, I've still got an hour left. And it doesn't have a traditional narrative arc. So you're not like, okay, cool, we're getting to the end. It's just like, all right, now this thing has happened. Now this thing has happened. It just keeps throwing out more and more ideas and more things. You're like, all right, cool, these characters are here now. Oh, there's, and there was a point where like, oh, there's Will Sasso. I haven't seen him since like the beginning of the movie. He's back now. But with all that stuff that they've been throwing out, all these ideas and stuff, did you have any like moments or parts that you thought were really great and really interested you?
Yeah, I think that the reason that this movie still lingers in our minds is because there are three or four parts of this movie, and everyone has something different, that do stick with you for a while. Like, everyone always points to the when Justin Timberlake takes the fluid karma, and then he's walking around lip-syncing to the Killer song. Like, that's, I don't know why it's in the movie, but it's very memorable. I love, and this was the part that I was waiting for with my wife. And in my memory, I think it may have been better than I thought it was, but I really enjoy it. The tracking shot of The Rock and Mandy Moore. Yes, Mandy Moore's in this movie. When they get onto the blimp, and it basically has every character in it. And it's probably like 4.5 minutes long. It is beautifully photographed. The choreography is excellent. The music is awesome. It's just an awesome scene. You could probably just YouTube that scene. Maybe that's all you really need to see of the movie, but I thought that was just, I was shocked that that scene out of nowhere and that stylization was in this movie after having watched it for 2.5 hours at that point.
Yeah, because that scene, I'm watching, I was like, did Scorsese direct this scene? Like, what is happening here? Because yeah, it is, I remember like having that, because I was kind of like a little bit honestly tuning out at that moment, and then that really drew me back in, where it's like you're just going through and seeing all these characters, and you follow down a bay for a while, and then this happens over here, and then there's the flag, and there's people on the stage and singing, and you're just like going through the whole part, and you're like, that is an immaculately shot, really great one-er. And yeah, there are moments like that where you'll start to drift or whatever, and then you'll pull you back. And you mentioned the Justin Timberlake lip syncing all these things that I've done. And that was the moment that really stuck out for me. Because longtime listeners of the show will probably know that The Killers are my favorite band. And I love it whenever they unexpectedly show up in a movie. You know, I did Spider-Man 3 a couple weeks ago, and they had a song in the credits, and I was like, oh, cool. And it's usually Mr. Brightside or something. So I was really excited to hear all these things that I've done. I was like watching, and I was like, I have no idea what is happening, like why this is like a thing. You know, like you said, it comes out of nowhere. But I was like, cool, like The Killers, this is awesome. And it just goes through the whole song, and you're like, cool, this is great. He's lip syncing the whole thing. I'm back on board. I can't possibly hate a movie that has all these things that I've done in it. It just doesn't work in my DNA. So I was back on board for that.
The other part that sticks out to me that I think that gets lost in all of this, because everything is, it's funny because some of the actors are playing it so subtle, but it's very bombastic, so it seems over the top. Sean William Scott is awesome in this movie.
Yes. Yeah, I would completely agree.
I don't get why he didn't have, I know he had a good career, and like Role Models is one of my favorite movies ever, but I just don't get how he didn't end up as like a lead on a prestige drama cop show or something like that. And you just don't expect it from him, but he has a physical presence in this movie. He makes two characters that seem somewhat, he's not as good as like Nicolas Cage in adaptation as playing two separate characters, but they are distinct characters, both on different timelines. Like his confusion in the movie, he's just fantastic. And he is by far the best part. And The Rock, I mean, I love The Rock, but I don't want to say he's miscast, because I think that The Rock today would be better in this movie, I think, than The Rock then.
Yeah, I think The Rock is interesting because The Rock is, he's kind of just, he only plays The Rock now. He's always the same guy. Even in the Fast and Furious movies, when he was kind of a different character, he's just kind of become The Rock. And I do appreciate, even though I don't, you know, think he's necessarily the best in some of these early movies, when he was still The Rock before he was Dwayne Johnson, you know, at least credited, when he was taking risks and he was trying to do different things and was trying to play parts in a different way. And he might not have been great in this, but I was like, cool, I'm getting to see him try something different, a different performance, a different angle than he usually takes. And I think that's true of pretty much the entire cast. You're like, these guys who wouldn't necessarily get to play these parts normally, you're getting to see them in these roles, a lot of comedic actors in more serious roles, you know? So I really dug that. Yeah.
Is Richard Kelly best friends with every early 90s SNL cast member's agent? Is that what happened?
I guess so. And also Kevin Smith, who I was just like, it took me a while to, but I was like, who the fuck is that? And I was like, oh my God, because he's got the beard and everything, but he's got such a distinct way of speaking. I was like, I recognize that voice. And it's like Kevin Smith. I was like, oh yeah. And it's funny because, yeah, he has an incredible cast in this. And it's funny because you watch the credits for this movie and just like the you know, the cast goes on forever. It just keeps going and going and going. And I like look down at my phone and then I look back up and I'm like, okay, gotta log this on Letterboxd. I look back up and like the cast list is still going for like the second minute. I'm just like, wow, okay. So he really just got everybody in this movie.
Yeah, I thought Sherry O'Terry was actually really good in this movie. Mm.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You mentioned Amy Poehler and Wood Harris as the slam poet couple, Dream and whoever it is. I think that's the funniest part of the movie is the double homicide with the squibs. Just cracked me up.
That was really good when like he gets shot for real and then the second squib. That I thought was hilarious. So I don't know. Do you think like this is actually supposed to be intended as a comedy, or do you think that like that this is just a retroactive thing? Because I kind of got vibes. I was like, this feels like it's maybe a farce. I don't know.
I can see the farcical elements of it. Mm-hmm. And, well, I do think that there are satirical elements in this movie, and there are certain scenes that are clearly written for comedy. It also wants to be taken seriously at the same time. Like, it's a end-of-the-world movie. So, like, what's the other end-of-the-world satirical movie, really, that you can think of? Strangelove, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it does seem like it's trying to pull from a lot of those like movies, these kind of classic, just big over the top farces.
The problem is that when you like in Strangelove, whether you have Commander Kong in the plane, he is an over the top character. He's playing everything straight, but like he is outrageous, and everyone kind of sees that he's outrageous. Or General Turgeson in the War Room, that he's over the top, and you know he's chewing gum the entire time. He's standing up and yelling at the Russian ambassador, but everyone else is taking it very seriously. You have a full commitment from almost the entire cast that no one's really playing. Like, The Rock is playing it the biggest, but I don't think that he was trying to play it big. It seems like he's trying to play it subtle. It's just The Rock can't do anything subtly just because he's a giant man.
Yeah, that's fair. And, you know, you mentioned Philip K. Dick, too, earlier, and it did give me vibes of definitely a lot of the adaptations that have come out of Philip K. Dick. I think the one it really reminded me of the most, and you know, speaking of like a big guy at the center of it, it gave me Total Recall vibes a lot, where it's just like, there's this guy and he's doesn't remember everything and he's just caught up in this huge conspiracy and everybody's like double crossing everybody and people who he thinks are on his side are actually on the other side. And he's actually just a pawn in this game and he doesn't know who he really is. So it really, and I love Total Recall. It's definitely one of like my favorite sci-fi movies, and this nowhere comes close to that. But I think that's another very smart movie that is very subtly and interestingly commenting on. It seems like a big, dumb, bombastic action movie with some comedy in it, but it is really commenting on, you know, the world we live in and society in a smart way. And this is maybe not doing it as intelligently, but it's going for those same vibes, and I do appreciate that.
I think you're onto something here. It's like a dumbed down version of a Philip K. Dick story or something like Total Recall. It's a lesser directed version of a vibes movie like a David Lynch movie. It's just, it has all these ideas taken as a satirical thing. Can you do it as good as Kubrick? Obviously not. He can't do it as good as Kubrick. He's like the middleman in all of this. It's like when Jeremy Lin got hot for like 3 weeks that one time. And, oh my God, Jeremy Lin. And then he just turned Insanity. Back into Jeremy Lin. Richard Kelly was like feeling himself here, having a heat check, and he just didn't have the talent to really pull it off. But I'm here for it anyway.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's like, you know, give these guys a shot. And if they don't work out, then, you know, whatever. We get some weird relic of the early 2000s or the late 2000s, you know, and why not? You know, why not like let this thing exist? I'm glad it's out there in the world.
Yeah, so I've been kind of going through it. Someone wrote this, and I actually don't know who it was, but I copied it down. And because there's different parts, there's like the religious aspect of this, but there's also the sci-fi aspect of it, and it takes place in the future. But there's a part where, like, if people don't know, like, the general plot synopsis, if I can try to do this, is that
good luck.
The Rock wakes up with amnesia in porn star Sarah Michelle Gellar's house, and they've written a screenplay together called The Power, which predicts the end of the world, which is actually what's happening within the reality of this movie. So everything in this script that they've written is actually what's going on to them in real life, culminating with the end of the world, unless you think that Sean William Scott actually saves them all in the end, where The Rock sacrifices himself for the people and the godlike figure of Sean William Scott saves and brings salvation to the people. I think that's what happens in the end. I could be wrong about that. But a part of it is that the world is slowing down because of this weird perpetual motion machine in the ocean. They're sucking fluid karma out of the core, and it's creating temporal rifts everywhere. I can see why people don't like this. But one of the things that it's doing, it's making the world really hot. So there's a climate change aspect of this as well. But it's also making people kind of crazy at the same time. It's making them more aggressive. That's why you see all of the riots downtown in Los Angeles. So to say all of that, this is what was written. I thought it was really the best way I've heard the movie explained. This movie is all about a world gone mad and how a bunch of disparate actors, all thinking that they should be in control or that they can save the world, all collide and each inadvertently contribute to the giant mess at the end. And the everyman in the middle who didn't understand what was happening and was just trying to do the right thing is left with nothing but to look himself in the mirror and try to tell himself that it's not his fault and he saves it in the end.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that's a good way of putting it. It's a much better summary than I think, you know, most people would be able to give of this movie. Because I even went on Wikipedia afterwards. I was like, I think I got that, but like, let me like get like a Cliff Notes version of it to just set my mind right. And I was like, nope, that didn't help at all. That covered maybe like a fourth of what was actually going on in the movie because there's just so much. And it's like, how do you talk about this? It's a lot of disconnected points. But I think you did a pretty good job of like summarizing it. And yeah, at the end, I was also kind of like, so I guess Sean William Scott did save the world. The whole thing about it can't be saved was wrong. But they do kind of leave that open to interpretation. The one other question for you that I had was, because I was the way I read it was that he was actually had been best friends with Pilot, with the Justin Timberlake character. And he had the reason that Justin Timberlake had to get the cosmetic surgery, why he had all those scars and everything, was because of some friendly fire done by Sean William Scott. Is that the right read? Are you getting the same vibes, or am I just off base here?
Yeah, no, so the graphic novels go into that a little bit okay. more, and they kind of cover that part of it. So yeah, they're best friends, they're in Iraq, because the draft is, I mean, that's another part of this, the draft right. is back in place. There are wars in Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Jordan that Americans are getting drafted into, but they can win all these wars because of this new technology where you don't need gas to refuel anything. So, and just like the Hustler advertisements on the side of tanks because everything is being broadcasted. Like, that's not too far away in the future either. But when they were both in Iraq, there was friendly fire. And yeah, there was like an explosion that Sean William Scott shot off and it hit Justin Timberlake in the face. Justin Timberlake forgives him, but Sean William Scott does not forgive himself about it. It took him having amnesia about the entire thing to reckon with it. Like, there's also a case that this movie is about Sean William Scott and PTSD at the same time, too. Like, just a lot of threads that don't necessarily all wrap itself around in the end.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those movies where the parts are more than the sum of the whole or whatever. And I did really like, though, that last scene with Sean William Scott in, and this is going to sound insane to, I was going to say anybody who hasn't seen the movie, but also anyone who has, where it's like the guy on the rocket launcher on the floating ice cream truck and Sean William Scott is holding his duplicate's hand and they're causing things to float above the sky. And that, I just loved that moment where he's like looking at himself being like, threatening to kill himself, and he's like, let go of me. And he has to literally forgive himself. And that's one thing that is really cool about these big, weird concept movies is you can take something that is bizarre like that, like the idea of forgiving yourself, and you can literalize it in a floating ice cream truck next to a magical zeppelin. And it's just like, you couldn't do that in like, you know, a more straightforward drama or something like that. But you get the opportunities to do that in these genre films that I love.
It's interesting you mentioned that too, because one of the Sean William Scotts wants him to let go so he can sacrifice himself and essentially kill himself at the last line of the movie. You know, he's a pimp. Pimps don't commit suicide.
Yeah, oh man, a callback. Because when LaRock says that, you're like, okay, whatever, that's weird. And then
it's a pretty out of left field, like, you're watching, it's like, ooh, that's bad writing. But the more you watch it, you're like, yeah, it's bad writing, but it's kind of funny. The Rock is an idiot. That's the whole part of it too, that I think, like, he gets to be The Rock. He gets, he looks, what, The Rock has never looked better than he did in that tux on the Zeppelin. Like, he looks fantastic. But he's also a complete moron in the movie too. Like, he's an actual idiot.
Yeah, I love that. And it's just like, you know, that's a role that Rock probably would not play now, where he lets himself just be an absolute moron. And I think he's actually pretty good at it. Like, I think Pain and Gain is my favorite performance ever by him. And he's just so dumb in that movie. And it's so great. Yeah. Honestly, once again, really great for actors to play these roles that they wouldn't play today or, you know, even before then.
There's also just a bunch of, I mean, I love, you know, like early 90s SNL, like I pointed out. I love Mad TV. So seeing Will Sasso appear in anything, I was like, oh, wow, this is fantastic. I haven't seen Will Sasso. I forgot Will Sasso existed. It's like Mad TV, Best in Show, this movie. That's, in my mind, the entire filmography of Will Sasso. But even someone like John Larroquette is in this movie, who... The last time I remember hearing John Larroquette, now I didn't watch the Night Court reboot, maybe he's in that, was him being referenced by Kitty on Arrested Development as her sponsor. But he never appeared in the show. And it was just, and I don't think his name was actually said, but that's just who she was alluding to.
That's funny, because, yeah, I always think of the reference that they make to him on Futurama, where it's like Bender is like digging up graves and he's like, now no one can't say that I don't have John Larroquette's spine. So... But yeah, so like I said, this is just loaded with just great character actors. It's also loaded, and I alluded to this earlier with the Killers, but it's also loaded with just great songs. I think this movie's soundtrack is phenomenal.
Moby did the entire soundtrack.
Yeah, and then, you know, that when they're lifting up in that bizarre scene I was talking about earlier, and you have the song, which is like an actual memory gospel, which is such a cool, like, I'm like, that really drew me into that scene in particular. But yeah, Moby, like you said, we've got a couple Moby songs on there. He did the soundtrack. We've got the Pixies. We've got the Killers, obviously. We've got, I think, is there some Muse in here? There's all kinds of just like Jane's Addiction, Waylon Jennings, like all these great, great art. Like, this is a great soundtrack. Am I right?
It is. And it's really interesting because the music budget probably wasn't all that big on this movie. Yet people probably signed off on their music at a much better rate than... normally wouldn't a big budget action movie or something like that to be in this movie. All these actors basically did this movie for scale just to be in this movie. So people read the script. They seemed to want to work with Richard. Like, everyone was just all in on Richard Kelly in 2006, apparently.
Yeah, it's like Cats. You know, people were like, let's get this huge cast of just big actors who were like, cool, maybe this will get me an Academy Award or something like that. Obviously, did not work out. But hey, you know, that means we got something weird and interesting from it.
But at least those actors were paid $20 million to embarrass themselves in Cats. These ones are getting like, you know, $1,000 a week or something.
Yeah, yeah, definitely that. These guys are working for scale. But yeah, I mean, yeah, you mentioned that at the top. This is something you probably would not get to normally talk about. And that's one thing I absolutely love doing about this show, is that these are movies that are not necessarily going to pop up anywhere. I got to talk about Cloud Atlas. I got to talk about watch Southland Tales. And this is one that I've always been kind of interested by. It's always been on the outskirts. I've heard so many things about it. Like, this is a disaster. This is a secret masterpiece, whatever, whatever. And so as soon as you mentioned to me, I was like, let's go, let's do it. Like, what was your initial reasoning? Like, what really made you want to just come on here and talk about this bizarre movie?
I think it's because I've been wanting to talk about this movie for so long, and I've seen it so many times. I revisit it once every 2-3 years or so, so I've probably seen it 7 or 8 times at this point. I finally just bought it on my TV. It's like, I just have it back there. I can tune into certain parts of it, but I just get sucked into it every time because I always forget. Like, the ending does, despite being 3 hours into the movie or whatever it might be, the ending eventually just sneaks up on you. It's like, oh, we're here. Like, I really like this part. The end is really good. So you're kind of just waiting for the end to happen and trying to, because when there's so many plots and threads and characters going on, and some of them are half developed or a quarter developed, whatever it might be, you forget that it doesn't go anywhere and you get kind of invested in like this part or that part. It's like, oh, that's the last time that we saw any of this. So it keeps you wanting more the entire time. I can always see how people get halfway through this movie and just turn it off or walk out of the theater, whatever it might be. It is most definitely a not for everyone movie.
Yeah, that's fair. And speaking of walkouts, you know, and the original, you know, the original cut apparently at Cannes had a bunch of walkouts. But that, have you seen, you mentioned that there is that cut that exists. Have you seen that cut?
I have not, no. Because okay. You mentioned Janine Garofalo, and I know that she's featured more in that cut. I think she's in maybe 3 seconds of the theatrical cut.
Yeah, because I know she's in a couple, because I kept seeing her and being like, oh, okay, like, she's in this, you know, and I'm a really big fan of hers, so whenever she pops up, I'm really excited. So I would be really curious to, like, know what these cuts are, because I've been really getting interested and invested in the kind of idea of a quote-unquote director's cuts. And, you know, I think that a lot of times they are great, and it's like, we get these movies that might not work, but kind of are artist's vision is kind of reimagined. But then on the other hand, sometimes it's like there are something where they're these big overindulgent things. And, you know, I think I'm not a big fan of the auteur theory and it just being like, yeah, the movie is just this one person's vision, because movies, unlike a novel or unlike, you know, a painting or something, they are so collaborative. You have the director, but and then the director and the writer are the same in this case, but writer, editor, actors, you know, lighting, like cinematographer, like so many different people. And with director's cuts, a lot of times you'll be like, okay, we're going to give this one person their vision, which is why I recently covered Spider-Man 3, and there's actually an editor's cut of that, which I am really interested by, and I think is a lot better than if Sam Raimi had gotten to do his director's cut. And I think, so it's kind of a double-edged sword. I'm interested by the idea of these longer director's cuts, these other alternate visions, but I think that they do lend themselves a little bit to being like, this guy's a secret genius. And I think watching this one, you could be like, yeah, this guy clearly probably thinks of himself as an auteur, of this genius, of this guy who both wrote and directed it. But he's not as much of a genius as he thinks of.
No, it's like he stayed up all night and realized he had to continue writing or continue directing and did a bunch of lines of cocaine and then was going to crash around like 3 p.m. And he smoked a bunch of weed for some reason to calm himself down. And this is sort of the mix that you get. There's this like overly aggressive, high energy stuff and this really weird, subtle satire and laid back stuff. And the performances don't necessarily match the tone of each scene that we're in. So it's just a lot of different things going into one. So this was the first time that you saw this movie?
Yeah, I had never seen it before. I was really interested to check it out. I knew its reputation, but I never had sat down and be like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sit down and watch 2.5 hours of this bizarre movie. And I probably should have, in all honesty.
So when you start watching it and you see like the first 4 minutes, which is like home video, handy cam, and then nukes go off, what did you think you were in for?
I thought I was in for some kind of like post-apocalyptic thing, like some gritty, like Terminator Salvation, like the world has ended, we're all living in the post-apocalypse. But like the nukes never really even matter that much. I felt like it was just like, I was kind of like, what was even the point of that? So it caught me off guard for sure.
Yeah, they were more of a catalyst to get us into this future. Mm-hmm. That we end up being in, and we exist in throughout the course of the movie. But yeah, very few movies world build like this. That's the one thing I will give this movie a lot of credit for. Although it's confusing at times, it does feel like a lived-in world where 95% of movies just feel phony and fake and not real. Although this movie feels phony and not real, the world itself feels very real and lived in.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of world building, of things that clearly put a lot of thought and effort into this world that it's set. That is a world that is very different from our own. I've talked about that a lot in movies like, you know, John Carter or whatever, where it's just like this bizarre, weird other world. And these characters are kind of having to live and experience in it. And I think that is one of the drawbacks of the film, is that we don't have this fish out of water, this point of view character that can kind of ease us into understanding what is happening, because it is just kind of throwing everything all at once at you, and you're just like, whoa, 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 this is a lot. Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, another one that I think draws a lot of parallels with this movie, where it's just like, there's a lot happening, there's a lot of weird world building, but that is something that is always going to really intrigue me, and what really intrigued me about this one.
Maybe the absence of a point of view character here to explain everything is, you know, maybe a part of the movie where both the main characters have amnesia. Maybe you're supposed to figure everything out along with them at the same time because they have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, that could be true. If, like, the point of this is you're supposed to be very disoriented and kind of not understand and feel like these characters who are lost in the world, who don't really understand anything and are trying to figure everything out, and at the end of the day, nothing makes sense. That makes sense with the tone of the movie, because this tone of the movie is about how much the world is changing and how much things just don't make sense and things don't fit together. And you have these evil tycoons that are purporting to save the world, and they're actually just ruining everything. And maybe in the end we need to blow it up. And it's like, yeah, I you know, are the people who are actually claiming to be, you know, the kind of quote unquote neo-Marxists or whatever, the people who are going to like save us from these evils, are they actually just like also in working with these people? And it's just, you're just like trying to track everything and you really can't. So if that was the intention, then I guess, you know, well done to this screenplay.
See, now you have come around to the entire space that the rest of us fans live in, of giving this movie retroactive credit for things it didn't mean to do.
There you go. That's a real sign of a work of art, is just giving. Because, like, yeah, I do that with a lot of movies. I give a lot of movies maybe more credit than they deserve, especially on this show. So that had to be the case with this one.
It does. Another thing that it does presciently point out is the polarization of both ends of the political spectrum. Like, even during the Bush time, it did feel like most of America and most people, and maybe it's still the case, and because of the amplification of social media, you just hear from these people that are on the fringes, they really get amplified more than anything. But it felt like centrist, slightly right of center, slightly left of center, that was the majority of people. In this movie, you have your extreme right, and then you have your neo-Marxist, which would be your extreme left, and they're both just kind of portrayed as just the worst people on earth.
Yeah, that is very true. We have seen, that's another way that it was kind of prescient in the intervening years, the disappearance of these just kind of moderates. You have just everybody on the extreme right. Even, like, I have a lot of, you know, these very hardcore, you know, old school Reagan aunts and uncles and stuff like that. You always see at Thanksgiving, and they are kind of like, what is even they are like, what is going on? Like, these, you know, all the MAGA people are like, just baffle them. And I think that, you know, this generation of political just complete division, just where everything has gone one way or the other, is something that this movie did a good job of predicting.
Yeah, I have no idea if he was really ahead of the curve on this, or he thought that this is so outrageous, this will never happen, and I'll throw it into this dystopian future, but we're living a lot of this future right now.
Yeah, honestly, and it's, you know, it's a thing where I think that the most dated thing, the least accurate thing, is the nukes at the beginning of this movie, because it's like, yeah, we didn't need this apocalypse to just start off this insanity. It just kind of happened naturally. You just had people like Trump showing up and just making everyone lose their mind. It's just people showing up. You know, it's a reality TV star becoming the president of the United States. And, you know, that seems like something that would have been, oh, laughably a farce, you know, 20 years ago. That would have been a joke on The Simpsons or something. But it's the reality that we've all lived through for the past, you know, 8 or whatever years.
Well, it's essentially, again, this movie comes out the same year as Idiocracy, and who's the president in Idiocracy? It's a professional wrestler.
Yes, exactly. And then, yeah, even something like, you know, Kevin Smith is in this. Like, it reminds me of something like Red State or something, you know? Like, all these, like, it seems like a lot of these guys had the kind of same ideas about the way things are going and the way the country was going.
Yeah, and I do appreciate that it doesn't pull its punches on sort of the crazy left-wing style of this as well. Like, where it takes some of the movements that we've seen and pushes them to the extreme. So maybe that's next of what we're going to see, which is not great.
Yeah, no, it's exactly. It's not taking any sides. It's just saying, like, it's kind of making the point that, like, yeah, extremism is bad in any direction. And, you know, having these kind of things where you become more devoted to an ideal, and then actually what, you know, you originally were fighting for is going to be a bad thing. And it brings that up time after time.
Which circles back to the center of the movie, which is Sean William Scott, who has amnesia, has no real affiliation to anything. He's kind of being used as a pawn. But when left to his own devices, both versions of his character are just good people. Like, he saves that guy from shooting himself in the head. He doesn't have to do that. He just does it because he feels the need to do it. He's just trying to help. And in the end, he is the one who saves everyone.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you watch the movie, you get the vibe that The Rock is the main character, or maybe Justin Timberlake is, because you're hearing his voiceover. But really, it is Sean William Scott is kind of the point of view character, the character that you do relate to the most, that you are rooting for the most. And you're at the end, his arc is, I think, by far the most satisfying.
Oh, for sure. Like, it's not until the end that you realize that he was the main characters at the of this movie. But then when you rewatch it again, you're like, oh, okay, that makes a lot more sense. Like, even when he first wakes up and you see that there are two of him and he's standing next to the mirror and it's like the weird, that's actually a really cool part of the movie too. When he's waving in the mirror and everything's on a 3-second delay in the mirror and he's just like, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, that part tripped me out. I was like, whoa, okay. This is it. Like, that was what the moment when I was like, all right, this movie's interesting. This movie's saying something. I don't know what it's saying, but I'm down for it.
Yeah, it might be in a foreign language, but I get the gist that it's trying to say something. Like, even in the place where he's being held hostage, you talk about all of the different people that are in this movie. When the government comes in to wipe them all out, they just shoot Eli Roth taking a shit.
Yeah, I forgot about that. But yeah, as we're kind of, sounds like we're all wrapping up a little bit. Do you have any, like, stray thought, any last kind of big things to say about this movie? Or small things?
Not really. I feel like I got it all out. All of the pent-up Southland Tales discourse that I've ever wanted to have, I feel like we've gotten out in the last hour.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, it was therapeutic. It was good for you to kind of be like, to just kind of, like, finally have a platform where you could get all this out. I'm glad.
The hardest part is recommending this movie to people. Because we're going to do a show on it. If you had hated this movie, it would have made a good show anyway, with me coming in saying that I like this movie. However, I'll probably end up doing a movie club about this on my show, and we'll release this episode along with it, and I'll encourage my audience to go watch this movie. And 9 out of 10 people are going to tell me to go fuck myself after like 10 minutes. Like, what is this shit?
And I think, too, the big hang-up that a lot of people might have is, like you said, and it's the same thing that a lot of people have had, is this movie's so long. And I think it is a real time commitment. And I think you can kind of give yourself over to something weird if it's a short one. Like the episode I'm going to record later that's actually going to be out by the time this is out is Fritz the Cat, which is also a just bizarre, weird movie where you're like, what is going on? But that movie is 70 minutes long. So you can kind of just settle in, watch it, be like, that was weird, and then go about your day. What this is like, it is a commitment. You really got to watch this movie. And maybe break it up. Maybe make it a TV show like we talked about. But yeah, so I'm curious to see, you know, what my audience thinks about it, what your audience thinks about it, because this is a movie where you're not just going to be like, yeah, whatever, it was fine. This is a movie where you're going to have some strong opinions one way or the other, and that's why I was so excited to kind of really get into it. But yeah, as we wrap up, I just have one more question for you, and that is, we talked about vibe movies a lot. Do you have any favorite vibe movies, one in particular or just a few that you really love?
I think the Mulholland Drive is a pure vibes movie. And basically the entire first half of Twin Peaks The Return but basically David Lynch is just a vibes director. Either you vibe with him or you don't. And I know so many people that hate David Lynch movies, whereas I just kind of, you get into his world, that's the great thing about it. Like, he creates a world. His world building is so good. And that's why I think that I like this movie so much, that it feels like the world really exists. And so few movies are actually able to accomplish that. That Mulholland Drive would be the one that really sticks out to me. I'm trying to think of anything else, like, as a vibes movie. Clockwork Orange, in a weird way.
Okay. I can see. Yeah, I mean, Kubrick, 12, definitely.
12 Monkeys is another one I think I would throw on that list of a vibes movie.
Okay, yeah. One I might add is, you said Mulholland Drive. Just Drive, I think, is a really good vibes movie, you know?
I hate that movie.
Okay, all right. Interesting.
I am in a weird minority of people who just, the first scene rules, the opening credits rules, and then nothing happens the rest of the movie. They could have replaced Ryan Gosling with a cardboard cutout of Ryan Gosling in that movie.
Well, I think, yeah, that speaks to the point of, yeah, it's one of those movies where it's just like, the plot's whatever, it's just vibes, you know? And some people, that'll really work for. Some people, it won't, just like this movie. Another one I would add is, like, a lot of Miyazaki stuff, I think, is very vibes, but his most recent one, I don't know if you got a chance to see The Boy and the Heron yet, but that is a movie. Okay. That is definitely a movie where you're like, what is even happening in this? What is going on? People are just going through things, doing things, but in a way that really works for me, just really incredible visuals, just like Miyazaki always does, but he brought on a lot of the other interesting animators on this one. That's another vibes. And it's funny because watching his movies a lot of the time, I'm like, I'm clearly like not getting something culturally because, you know, I'm a white guy who grew up in America. So this is a Japanese movie with very Japanese sensibilities. I'm clearly missing something. But I saw Boy and the Heron in the theater with someone who was born in Japan and who goes back there frequently. And even she was like, yeah, I wasn't getting like half this movie, but we still really appreciated it. So that's one I think has to be on the vibes Mount Rushmore. Possibly with this movie.
Yeah, and I think that works differently because everyone's vibe is going to be different, like what you personally vibe with. So there's going to be a lot of different answers to this question. But the last few movies that I would throw into that would be the Connery Bonds from Goldfinger through like Diamonds Are Forever. They're just like Goldfinger's great, but then it's like kind of the same movie over and over. And it's, are you vibing with Sean Connery as Bond or are you just out on this?
That's a good point. Yeah, the Connery, every Bond has really had their own flavor. But yeah, the weird swinging 60s Sean Connery Bonds are their own beast.
I hate Roger Moore Bonds. I love Connery Bonds.
Thank you.
They're
cannot stand
vibes.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why everyone has their own favorite, you know. I'm on the same boat. I really don't like Roger Moore. I think he's just like old and literally a clown in one of those movies. I'm a big Brosnan guy. Like, I love Pierce Brosnan. But probably that's because I grew up in the 90s, but I do dig on the vibes of those movies. Especially the ones that get kind of weird, you know, the later ones, like the last two. You're like, what is happening? There's a guy with diamonds in his face who, like, changed from a Korean guy to a white guy. Like, there's a tidal wave that he's surfing. Like, what is happening here? Like there's, like, somebody with, like, Stockholm. So, like, there's so much. That's enough. Those last two are, like, just throwing a lot of weird stuff at you, and they're like, we can do whatever we want. It's a James Bond movie.
Yeah, the last one's Die Another Day, right?
Yeah, Die Another Day, yeah. And then, because it's GoldenEye, Tomorrow Never Dies, Die Another Day, and then I forget the fourth one. People are probably shouting at us right now, but...
Tomorrow Never Dies, which is... There's one with Terrence Stamp or Malcolm McDowell as like as the Rupert Murdoch one. I like
that's,
that.
Yeah, that's Tomorrow Never Dies. That one's really good. I've actually covered that on this show. I think that's a
world
pretty underrated.
World is not
movie.
Enough. Is that it?
World is not enough. Yeah, yeah. With Denise Richards as like the like she's like a nuclear physicist and she's just like Her name is like Christmas
and,
or something like that.
Robert Carlyle is the bad guy because he feels no pain in his brain.
Oh yeah, that's the thing. And like the bullets going into his brain, so he doesn't feel any pain. That's an interesting movie, and it kind of like predicted the plot. It, like Quantum of Solace kind of like ripped off the plot of that movie a little bit, I feel like. But yeah, that's when Bond was allowed to just. I love it when Bond movies are just like allowed to be weird, you know. Whenever they're like, okay, we're gonna take it back down to a strippy, gritty Bond. I'm like, that's a good movie. But when it's like, this is gonna be weird. There's an evil organization that runs everything in the world. I'm like, okay, cool. I appreciate this.
Yeah, and the Craig Bonds really both benefited and suffered from that. Mm-hmm. Casino Royale is really good. Obviously, Skyfall is excellent. The other three are too serious and bad. Like, the best part of the last Bond movie is sort of the throwback to old Connery Bond movies. When he goes to Cuba, he meets up with a spy there. They do a shootout in, like, the nightclub. They're dancing. Like, it's weird. And, like, it's... There's not many parts of the new Bonds that are fun. And I've always found that James Bond's supposed to be fun.
Yeah, and there's that scene in the last one where they roll out Christoph Waltz on that, like, Hannibal Lecter slab or whatever. And he's like, I don't know if it's supposed to be funny, but I thought it was hysterical. I was dying in the theater. And I was like, I'm enjoying this. Whether or not that was the intent of the director, this scene is really working for me on a comedic level. And so, you know, a lot of that stuff in that last movie was big and weird and goofy, and they're like on the secret island fortress, and that like nothing makes sense with the timelines. They're like, there's a virus that'll kill you, but it's nanobots, and it's just like, cool, what? And it's like, if James Bond ever sees the woman he loves again, she'll die, and it's just so weird. I love it when Bond is weird.
And like Mally Remick, is that his name? No, Remy Malek is his name. Okay, I got the dyslexia on his name going, but he's basically like just a knockoff of the Javier Bardem character from Skyfall. Even his location is one. So it's like someone watched Skyfall and then watched Star Trek First Contact and like fused them together for the plot of this movie. And it wasn't great. The second half of that movie sucks. The first half is great.
Yeah, honestly, I completely agree. And I think it's, you know, Bond is always really interesting because, and this is something I knock it for, sometimes yields some weird results, is that the Bond movies are so just like, whatever's popular, they'll just copy, you know? Like you know, the early greedy Bond movies is because Bourne was really popular. So they're like, okay, cool, we're going to make him like Jason Bourne-esque. Or like, you know, I think my favorite example is in the 70s, they like one of the movies ended with like James Bond will return, and I think it was like said Diamonds Are Forever. And then all of a sudden Star Wars is a huge hit, so they're like, actually, just kidding, Moonraker, he's going to space. You know, and then eventually they did do a Diamonds Are Forever, but they're very reactionary movies. And sometimes that yields bizarre genre combinations and results.
Well, we've got to the point where we're talking about all the Bond movies. I think we're good.
I think that's a good point to leave it. Before we go, though, Pat, why don't you tell the people where they can find you, all the good stuff that you do?
Yeah, at the PME on X, where you can always find me, tweet at me, do whatever. I'm still going to call it Twitter. Calling it X is just weird.
Right.
The Mayo Media Network on YouTube for all of the videos that I put out. Also on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever it might be, the Pat Mayo Experience audio podcast. I release a show 6 times a week, predominantly sports, but not always. Sometimes it's a comedy episode. Sometimes it's an Oscars preview episode, whatever it might be. Although we'll probably talk about the Oscars about how you bet on the Oscars rather than review movies. So if we talk about vibes, Derek, it's a completely different vibes type show than this.
Well, you know, I do have a lot of fans who are sports fans. You know, I myself am a big sports fan. So, you know, I'm not a sports betting fan. That's more my brother. But, you know, I definitely appreciate that stuff. I think that I have some listeners who there is the cross. So there's some Venn diagram in the middle there. So I think that's good. But yeah,
well, just know that we're not actually good at sports betting. It's just a device for us to talk about the sports.
Right. Well, you know, you need a way to enter, you know, and so yeah, that's important. But yeah, and then yeah, if anybody out there, if this is your first time listening to the show, we're Underrated Movie Podcast everywhere on Instagram and all the social media platforms. Have YouTube as well, and as well as a Patreon, patreon.com/underratedmoviepodcast, where we do a bunch of bonus stuff, including a sports movie show where we review a sports movie every month. But yeah, you can get a bunch of bonus content there if you want to follow us anywhere. We've always got the questions on Spotify if you want to answer whether or not you think the movie is underrated or not, and then usually I'll put up another poll there that you can answer. So give us a like, give us a follow, all the places. If you want to give us 5 stars on whatever app you're listening on, that helps the show out a ton. But yeah, Pat, thank you once again for coming on and bringing this truly bizarre movie to me.
Thanks for having me.